If you've been interested in the story of Katie O'Shea and whether she's missing or was murdered, you might like our new podcast about two little girls that went missing in Adelaide in 1973. It's the story of a sister who's searched for answers for 47 years and involves a $1 million reward, an Adelaide pedophile ring, and an unlikely bikie who's helping in the search for answers, and a family's disturbing dark secrets told from jail. We thought we'd bring you this first episode in this feed, and if you'd like to hear the next few episodes, which are released each Monday, head over to Little Lost Girls on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. It was a sunny Saturday in Adelaide on the 25th of August 1973. It was getting close to footy finals time, and Les and Kathy Ratcliffe and their young son David and daughter Joanne were excited to watch their beloved Norwood on the Redlegs play.
The Rover put it forward from centre wing towards centre half forward. Hobby in the front spot, couldn't pull it down. Knocked on intelligently by Sorrell. Full mark for that one over the Grimwood. He's slow, the little Rover, but gets his boot in towards the goal just in time to squeeze.
On the other side of town, four-year-old Kirsty Gordon was not as excited about a football game, but she was excited about being with her nan for the day, who was a Norwood fan and was planning to take her granddaughter to her fortnightly ritual at Adelaide Oval. The day started like any other, but by the time the sun went down, two families' lives were changed forever.
Well, of all the baffling crimes that have been committed in this city, few are more heartbreaking than the disappearance of Kirsty Gordon and Joanne Ratcliffe.
We're particularly looking for information concerning the happenings at the Adelaide Oval during the last quarter of the game.
This is Little Lost Girls. Episode 1. Has anyone seen my daughter? Susie Ratcliffe never met her sister Joanne. She was born 14 months after Joanne went missing. Over the past 47 years, she's made it her life's work to not only help find an answer about her sister, but help other families who are suffering loss due to a long-term missing person. I'll explain more about the Leave a Light On Foundation later in the podcast, but for now, let's meet Susie and learn about her big sister, Joanne.
Joanne, she was my sister. A very much loved daughter, adored sister to my brother David, but she was also cheeky and mischievous and kind-hearted, stubborn, pig-headed, so many words to describe her. She would sort of take on, you know, the responsibilities to look after other kids, even if they were older than her. She would constantly sort of mother my brother, even though he was nearly two years older than her. She'd constantly telling him, oh, you shouldn't be eating that, shouldn't be doing this. David, you should behave yourself. David, don't say this. And he used to rib her about that quite often. He used to say, oh, you know, you should have been the older one.
She's quite an old soul then.
Very much so. I reckon she'd lived this life before.
Although Susie had never met her sister Jo, as she told me a story, you get the feeling that although they never physically met, they would have been very close.
Well, growing up, we used to have a photo of my brother and sister on the mantelpiece in our lounge room. And I always used to wonder who that little girl was. And my family, after, you know, many questions, finally told me that that was my sister, and unfortunately some bad men had taken her away before I was born. Mum and Dad always answered any of the questions I had about her. So I grew up learning all the different traits and characteristics of Joanne and what she was like.
Were there any voice recordings or any audio of Joanne or video that you've been able to watch in the years since her disappearance?
No, sadly not. Only photos, lots of photos.
There's that sort of one piece missing, which is that hearing her voice, I guess.
Yes, very much so. You know, I remember my brother telling me a couple of different stories that will stick in my mind forever. One was he'd been bullied at school by a couple of boys that were older than him, and on the way home from school one afternoon, the three of them, they hijacked him, and they were beating him up and attacking him. And Joanne, and she was about 9 at the time, she kept trying to intervene and trying to get the other kids to leave David alone. And because they wouldn't, she found a piece of wood and she hit one of them over the back of the head and knocked him flat. And the other two took off. You know, they were petrified that she was going to hit them too. And it was funny because later that night, the kid's dad turned up at our house, and he was, you know, quite angry and was accusing my dad that he was going to go to the police and get them to, you know, have words with Joanne and David. And all my dad said to him was, "You really want to admit that your 14-year-old boy got knocked out by a 9-year-old girl half his size?" And that was it.
Wow.
Never saw or heard from them again. But that's what she was like.
So Joanne wasn't afraid really, right? She quite confident then.
Oh, no. No, very much so. Very much so. If there was someone that she cared about or she thought was the underdog, then she was very, very protective.
Doing the math of Susie's birth, it would seem that in the depths of Les and Kathy's search for their daughter Joanne, there might have been a moment or two where they're consoling of each other and their deep despair for their missing only daughter led to a miracle birth.
Mum didn't actually know she was pregnant for the first few months. Because of the stress, she just believed that her menstrual cycle was affected by that. And it wasn't until she went into the doctors to get another prescription for her Valium, which they prescribed for her, that the doctor diagnosed her as being pregnant.
You would have been somewhat of a miracle baby.
Yes. Yep. They, Mum was told by the doctors that I was the child sent to keep her sane. But many times over the years she told me that I've probably sent her insane.
Let's take you back to Adelaide in 1973. There were Vietnam War protests down King William Street in the early 70s, like most Australian cities.
What are you protesting about?
I'm protesting about the war. It is a present.
Each year, families would be drawn to the city to watch the annual Christmas pageant.
It's almost like a party, really, like a big masquerade party, and everybody just goes there to have fun.
It's very difficult to just sum up. I mean, it's the whole family enjoying something that is just an absolute spectacle, and it's a spectacle for us as well.
Prosh Week was a week of stunts by the University of Adelaide students who would do everything from dress up to hang an FJ Holden from a bridge over the River Torrens. There was a music festival that resembled Woodstock, and then there was the footy.
Coming through John Wimbrank is a Port Adelaide player, Darryl Pale, to the ground and the elbow.
Australian rules football. Long before the national competition, it was teams like Glenelg, Port and Norwood, or the Redlegs, with players like Rod Pope, Michael Greig, all household names in Adelaide in the 70s. There was also a dark side to Adelaide before 1973. Jane, Anna and Grant Beaumont were abducted from Glenelg on Australia Day in 1966 and never seen again.
On Australia Day 1966, Jane, Anna and Grant Beaumont came here to do what Australian kids relish, just a few hours on the beach at the end of the long summer school holidays.
The case resulted in the largest police investigation in Australian criminal history until recent cases like Daniel Morecambe and William Tyrrell. Police investigations revealed that on the day of their disappearance, several witnesses had seen the children on and near Glenelg Beach in the company of a tall, blonde and thin-faced man with a suntan complexion, of thin to athletic build, aged in his mid-30s.
You did lead the men this morning to this inlet, into the manhole in the Broadway.
That's true.
Now, do you believe that the children are in this pipe? Do you think that there's a possibility they could be there?
The Beaumont children was a very high-profile case of three kids from the same family who were abducted 7 years before the last known sighting of Joanne Ratcliffe and Kirsty Gordon at Adelaide Oval. For a long time, the disappearance of Kirsty and Joanne was dwarfed by the much-publicised Beaumont children. Susie knows a lot about the case of the Beaumont children, as does most of Australia. Not just because it was in Adelaide, but because of some of the similarities between the two missing persons cases.
Well, there's a couple of links. I mean, there's only I think maybe three or four cases in Australia where multiple children have been kidnapped at the same time. Two cases, of course, in South Australia. The suspect in both cases looks eerily similar. Witnesses that have come forward in both cases have basically described a tall, slim man, very similar in facial structure in both cases. And the fact that they've disappeared from a public area and there are very few witnesses, and it's such a small town, basically. It just, you know, there has always been that talk that the cases are linked. Whether or not they are, who's to know, except for the person who did this crime or these crimes.
We'll come back to the similarities between the two cases later in this podcast, but now let's head back to hearing more of Joanne as a kid and her relationship with her big brother, David.
Oh, very close. Very close. They did everything together. They got into trouble together. They blamed each other. And even though they had the usual brother-sisterly squabbles, they simply adored each other. If David was out playing football with his mates, Joanne was two steps behind. They'd walk to school together, they'd walk home together. Whatever David was doing, Joanne wanted to be involved. And the adoring brother that he was, he would let her.
So where did the family grow up?
We grew up in Campbelltown of Adelaide. We lived in a little housing commission home. That was, of course, had the two sort of joined together. My dad was a bread carter and my mum was a stay-at-home mum. So, you know, we didn't have a huge income coming in. So that's, yeah, they lived in this quaint little home.
And what were Joanne's hobbies growing up, do you know?
She loved her basketball. Loved playing football with the boys. She was quite crafty. I still have a little ashtray that she made out of clay for my mum. That very wobbly. it's certainly not what you would class as elegant, but it's a treasured piece that will be handed down in our family for generations to come. She loved to do reading and maths. She was really good with that, and of course sports. She was very active in her sports and got good grades for all of those. Mm-hmm. Although she did tend to sort of get sidetracked. She was very much a chatterbox. The teachers would quite often say, Joanne, pay attention. Joanne, stop talking. Joanne, get down the front here.
And she was also a big AFL or SAFL football supporter, right?
She loved Norwood Football Club. Or the Red Legs, love to go to the games and watch the boys running around the football oval.
It's a grand old flag, it's a high-flying flag, it's the emblem for me and for you.
Tell me about your mum and dad. What sort of parents were they?
I don't remember much of my dad, unfortunately, because he passed away when I was seven. But my mum, she was amazing. She was my inspiration for so many things throughout life. You know, when I felt that I couldn't do something or I didn't have the strength or just the knowledge to do something, She'd get out there with her proverbial cattle prod and give me a poke in the bum and say, come on, you can do it, at least try. You know, she was very strong-willed, very determined, and she inspired me throughout life and continues to do so.
When Joanne disappeared, did it consume your mum and dad?
It did. Mum, she didn't have a breakdown, but the doctors did worry about her mental state of health, hence the reasoning for putting her onto Valium. My dad, it consumed him. He was constantly out searching, looking for any piece of information or any evidence of the girls. He also took every opportunity to get into the media in whatever way possible to remind the public about the girls and, you know, play for information.
There's a interesting position there where, in real terms, you followed in your dad's footsteps in a way.
I have. His strength and determination is certainly installed in me. I have a lot of his traits. But, you know, it's not just about Joanne now anymore. It's with Leave a Light On, it's about all missing persons. And, you know, I just want to be able to help other families and not to have to go through what we've gone through.
We've got a good picture of family life at the Radcliffes, a close family with a hardworking dad and a mum who would tend to their household. Joanne and David were close, and although Joanne was younger, she was very grown up for her age. Saturday, August 25, 1973, was when the lives of both the Radcliffe family and the Gordon family changed forever, and Adelaide lost its innocence again.
Our family have been Norwood football supporters for many years and would quite often go to the games. Adelaide Oval was a regular for my family, and we used to sort of go between there and the Norwood Football Oval to watch a lot of the games. So we knew the layout. The family would sit in the same area of the oval, at the Adelaide Oval. When my family turned up at the oval on that day, Rita, a woman that they knew from previous games, was sitting there as well. And they got talking, and she mentioned that she had her granddaughter, Kirsty, with her because Kirsty's mum and dad had gone away for the weekend up to the Barossa Valley with their younger baby. So Kirsty was staying with Rita for a couple of days. My family had never met Kirsty before, so it was sort of a first for them. Joanne, being the motherly type that she was, instantly took Kirsty under her wing and was playing with her and talking with her. You know, football doesn't appeal to everybody, and for a four-year-old child it gets pretty boring pretty quick. So Joanne had helped, you know, just keep her entertained. The game was Norwood versus North Adelaide. The game was pretty intense.
Port Adelaide back into the game now. Quite right, they are back in the game. There's only 26 points of difference, and I made the comment at three-quarter time that Port Adelaide are never beaten, and they're not at the moment as we're back in the centre of game with Chris Knapp. He thumps it forward, but it's taken across by Pat Gill.
The adults got quite involved with the game. So, as I said, Joanne just took Kirsty under her wing. Throughout the game, the girls went and got straws for their drinks and then come back. There was not a problem. There was a rule with our family that we weren't allowed to, as kids, wander around the grounds in between the quarters or at halftime, just because there were so many people, just didn't want the kids getting trampled on or getting underfoot of the adults. So Kirsty needed to go to the toilet at some at one point in the game, and Joanne could see that the adults were caught up with the game. So Joanne offered to take Kirsty to the toilet, and they went off and then come back again.
So they came back in that first time.
Yes.
She went to the toilet with no issues, and then and then came back and sat down.
Yep, they came back, sat down in the stand, and continued watching the game and playing.
Do you know how far the toilet was from where they were sitting? Is it was a long way, or was it a short walk, or?
No, no, it was just basically under the Sir Edward de Smith stand, so it was only just a probably 15, 20 metres away.
Okay. Pretty close.
Yes, very much so. And then, as I said, later in the game, in the third quarter, Kirsty needed to go to the toilet again, so Joanne took her down. Previously when they'd gone to the toilet, it'd only been like 5-10 minutes at the most. When the siren sounded for the end of the third quarter, the kids had been gone for about 10, 15 minutes, and Mum and Dad started to worry. Mum went looking for her, couldn't find them. So she's sort of gone back to the stand thinking that she might have passed them and not realised. But when they realised that the girls weren't at the stand, they did a bit of a search around the area. And when they couldn't find them, they went to the announcer's office and they wanted to put an announcement over the radio.
Did that announcement ever happen?
Not initially, no. Mum was actually stopped by a security guard at the announcer's office. She wanted to make the announcement, but they said no. She pushed her way through. They underestimated the determination of my mum. And when she spoke with the the guy in the office, he told her that no, he wouldn't make the announcement because the noise of the crowd was too much and it wouldn't be heard. So he told her to go back to the stand and wait, because the girls would probably turn up. They'd probably be there right now while she was talking to him. So Mum went back to the stand. The girls hadn't still returned. So my mum, dad and my brother decided to go searching around the oval. They searched in behind the oval. There was a lawn bowls or something behind. There was a tennis court. So they looked all around there as well. Three parts of the car park, but couldn't locate the girls. My dad did stop and ask somebody that was working at the Oval, and he said that he'd seen the girls. They were trying to coax some kittens out from behind the John Creswell stand, which, knowing Joanne, my dad thought straight away, yep, that was definitely her, because she was notorious for trying to take home any stray animal that she find. By this stage, it was nearing the end of the fourth quarter. They still hadn't been able to locate the girls. Rita had stayed behind in the stands just in case the girls would come back, and sadly they hadn't arrived. So at this point, they then returned to the announcer's office and requested again to have an announcement made. They finally did it, but by this time the game was over and a lot of the people had already left the oval. So it was too little too late.
And a football quarter is about 30 minutes, and so you're talking 45, 50 minutes after the initial them going to the toilet until the announcement was made over the ground PA system.
Yeah. And in that 40, 45 minutes, you can cover a lot of distance.
After that announcement's done at the ground and obviously I'm guessing your parents continue to search, what happens next? When do they contact police?
Well, they contacted police once the game had finished. Police turned up pretty quickly, being in such a close proximity to the police station. It was only a couple of streets away. A number of police arrived fairly quickly. Another search was performed of the oval and the surrounds. But, yeah, sadly it was, as I said, too little too late because most of the people had already gone. So anyone that might have seen anything was, you know, they'd already left.
Joanne knew the oval pretty well. She knew the area.
Oh, very much so. Joanne had been going to the Adelaide Oval since she was a little girl. Her and David had played just about every nook and cranny of that oval. So she knew the area. She knew the grounds. You know, she knew where she was allowed to go and not allowed to go. And she was a even though she was cheeky and mischievous, she knew that she, what mum and dad said, she abided by.
She stuck by the rules during the game where she wouldn't go to the toilet in the quarters because that was the rule of your family.
Yes.
There was also some stuff written that she had a pretty good self-awareness, so she knew the number of emergency services, for example.
Oh, very much so. After the Beaumonts disappeared, it was one a really strict upbringing for my brother and sister about knowing the stranger danger and, you know, what to do if they were approached by a stranger, who to contact, you know, try and protect themselves if they were grabbed in any way. So Joanne knew that if she needed to ring 000 or to go to the nearest adult who she felt she could trust.
Even though Cole Lehman's been long retired from the police force, it's a case he can never forget.
I had a very good staff on, quite a few detectives and so forth working with me, men out in the field and, of course, men in the operations room, sifting through everything that came in. There was a terrific amount of stuff we went through, but all to no avail eventually.
Now he has a new theory on who might have been responsible.
It was a crime that one would think was a part of child abuse type of thing, you know.
So do you think there could be a link between, what, pedophilia and the abduction of these children?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No doubt about that. Oh, yes.
There was someone who came forward and said that he'd seen the girls trying to get kittens out from behind the stand. Uh-huh. And there was a tall gentleman who was helping them, trying to coax them out.
Over the next 90 minutes, it's been written that there were four different sightings of a man and the two girls. One of those sightings was that that they saw Joanne distressed, and in one case a man was driving past, saw one girl over the shoulder of a man, the other being dragged by the hand, both looking quite distressed. And this gentleman was going to stop his car but decided against it because he thought maybe they're just two kids being misbehaving and that was their dad taking them home.
A gentleman did come forward. He'd been driving past and he'd seen the two girls and the abductor walking across the bridge, the Torrens River. Joanne was really distressed and pulling on his arm and, you know, basically struggling with him. And he felt that something was wrong. You know, he just thought, you know, it didn't look right. And he did go so far as to slow his vehicle down. He was going to stop and sort of ask if everything was okay. But then he thought better of it because he thought, oh, it's just the, you know, dad taking the kids home from the zoo and they don't want to go, because it was literally not far from where the Adelaide Zoo is. Mm-hmm. So he thought it's none of his business. I'll keep going. And it wasn't until following days when he actually heard on the radio about the two girls being abducted from the Adelaide Oval that he put two and two together and realised that he had, in factual fact, seen the girls being taken. He's actually contacted me through Facebook a number of years ago, apologising profusely, blaming himself for not doing something. And as I've said to him, it's not his fault. He wasn't to know. You know, you don't expect to witness something like this. And, you know, it's not something that you would consciously think about. We don't blame him. You know, we don't have any anger or anything against him for not stopping. You know, I'm just thankful that, you know, he come forward with that information, because it gave a description of what the man looked like to police.
There was another report that both Kirsty and Joanne were seen about 3 kilometres from the Oval, 90 minutes after they'd left it.
Somebody had seen them, I think it was around Port Road at Theberton, which is not far from Adelaide Oval. The same thing. The guy was carrying Kirsty and Joanne was being sort of dragged along behind. By this time, you know, they were a bit of a distance away from the Adelaide Oval. So, you know, back then we didn't have CCTV footage or instant radio access, or, you know, we didn't have social media. So I think alerts couldn't be put out straight away. So nobody would think that this is anything unusual, that, you know, the kids were possibly in danger. So, you know, kids misbehave, parents discipline them, you know, especially back then it was, discipline was a lot more strict than what it is now with kids. So people just didn't interfere.
There's no doubt in your mind that it was an abduction.
Oh, most definitely. Joanne wouldn't have gone with anyone. She knew the dangers and she wouldn't have just wandered off. She wasn't that type of child. She wouldn't upset mum and dad by going against their rules.
What do you know of how the next few days transpired for your family?
It was an emotional roller coaster. You know, there was visits from the police, there were visits from friends and family. Dad spent a lot of time at the Adelaide Oval, going through like the girls' last known steps, walking around the Oval, speaking with police, copious amounts of interviews, radio appeals,
we're still following up the reports of people who have seen, or they've seen this man, know him, and our troops are pretty fully engaged in checking out all of this information's coming in.
With the disappearance of the Beaumont children still fresh in the minds of the public, the abductions of Joanne Ratcliffe and little Kirsty Gordon again raise the shocking spectre of evil lurking within the shadows of Adelaide's placid streets.
David couldn't go to school. It was just too upsetting for him. You know, he basically had to grow up overnight. Like he went from being a 13-year-old boy to a 13-year-old man.
Did David blame himself in any way?
Every day since. He blamed himself because usually him and Joe went everywhere together. They did everything together. They got into mischief together. And he blamed himself that he hadn't taken the girls to the toilet, because his belief was if he'd have gone with them, they'd still be here.
In the next episode of Little Lost Girls.
We believe his sighting is very credible, in the fact that he admitted that he had a bit of a crush on Joanne. he'd seen her in past games, and he'd sort of been watching her. Fairly tall man who was stooped, like walking like as if he, he had a bit of a sore back sort of thing. Very, quite thin.
This week we've attended several sites at properties at Yatna, which is in the mid-north of the state. We've spent 3 days excavating a well. We will continue to do anything we can to try and find the girls, find who was responsible for their abductions.
There was a doctor's book in a cupboard in the lounge room, and when it was a prescription properties guide. You know how a book's been opened frequently to a certain page? Well, it is open to a page where it tells you how to use particular drugs to put somebody in a hypnotic trance.
Yes, the gentleman that was dressed in women's clothing, a number of people come forward in regards to him because he was sort of loitering around where the ladies' toilets were. A couple of suspects that fit the description and have also correlated with the suspect in the Beaumont children case.